Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Art of Living series, our guest today is chef, writer, recipe developer, cooking teacher, and popular public speaker, Sherry Castle. Sherry Castle is from North Carolina, and she has wonderful stories to tell. As a matter of fact, she believes she is a storyteller, and I'm here to tell you that she is. She also believes that stories happen only to those who can tell them. Join me today in welcoming Sherry Castle, and join me and Sherry at the Smithsonian Associates event November 3rd, 2016, in the Ripley Auditorium in downtown Washington, D.C., at 6:45 until 8:45. Sherry will be there speaking. Her topic is shuck beans, stack cake, and chocolate gravy. That's right, I said chocolate gravy. Sherry's going to be there also to sign her new book, The New Southern Garden Cookbook. It's going to be available there for sale, and then Sherry, of course, will sign it. So join me today in welcoming to the Not Old Better Show, Sherry Castle. Welcome, Sherry Castle, and Sherry, it is just a pleasure to talk to you. I know that you're going to be joining us at the Smithsonian Associates coming up on November 3rd. We'll talk a little bit about that. First and foremost, along with a big hearty welcome from us here in Washington, D.C., I want to just make sure that our audience knows that you are a storyteller, along with being a very famous chef and author. And so I love that noun, storyteller. And I just want to start off by maybe asking you a question about that in relation to food. What is it about food that really almost requires a story to be told about it?
Well, I think that stories go hand in hand with good food, because when you ask someone to describe something that they prepare for someone they love, or that someone who loves them made for them, we don't talk about the amount of ground black pepper. We talk about how it made us feel and what it made us remember. And it opens up a whole set of evocative responses that are a form of story because they matter to us. It's not factual, but it's true.
I'm from an era when, food was, my mom was a school teacher, but she was a great Southern cook herself. She prepared breakfast and dinner for my dad and me and my two sisters every single day. And so I remember all of those tastes, and I remember kind of sharing around the dinner table. Tell us a little bit about your childhood and what took place around your dinner table, because I imagine there was a lot of talk about food that really has shaped you into the cook and the chef that you are today.
Well, there is. I had basically two forms of a childhood table. I grew up in western North Carolina in Watauga County, which is right in the northwestern corner of the state at the intersection of where North Carolina, Virginia, and Tennessee come together. My grandparents' house was in the state of North Carolina, but their cows grazed in Tennessee. That's how close they were to the state line. But they, when I was very small, moved into the town of Boone, North Carolina to stop farming and take factory jobs. So I went to school in town. Now, when I was eating with my grandmother, it was that traditional Southern, not just Southern, but mountain Southern spread, you know, where they cooked from the garden. Things were simple and delicious. Lots of vegetables. Meat was a condiment. And, you know, we did have a good time around the table, but I'm not sure we had a lot of food conversations per se, because when you're just doing what you do, you don't realize you're having a rich cultural immersion experience. You just think you're eating supper with your grandparents. So it wasn't until I got older and traveled around the world a little bit and got some perspective that I realized just how much cultural import I had been blessed with having growing up, and it changed my perspective as a chef and a food writer both. Now, when I was around my mom and dad's table, my mother did not cook at all. I mean, she, Now, that's well said and accurate. She just didn't cook at all. We did a lot of Swanson's TV dinners and things like that. And so, you know, it's a completely different perspective. But I think that in some ways that's insightful, too, because my parents came of that generation where they finished high school in the 1950s, and lots of folks were fleeing the farm, fleeing that very difficult life, and they went to town and got town jobs and never looked back, you know, never even so much as raised a tomato plant. So it was interesting that I sort of am bridging the gap of those things. I'm trying to carry forward some of the traditions, a lot of the traditions that I got from my wonderful Blue Ridge Mountain grandparents. And sometimes family traditions aren't just handed down, they're handed back up, because now that my dad is retired and in his 70s, he's curious about some of those things. So it's interesting that I'm bridging some generations out of order with our food stories and our food ways.
We are with Sherry Castle. Sherry is going to be at the Smithsonian Associates Lecture Series November 3rd at the Ripley Auditorium from 6:45 to 8:45. She's going to be talking about a lot of great things. One of those things will be the new Southern Garden Cookbook, which she's going to be signing copies of. They'll be available there for purchase. Sherry has come down off the mountain to talk to us a little bit about today about some of her history with food. And I love that story about eating with your grandparents. I think those traditions, they revolve around food and they revolve around table manners too. I've heard you talk a little bit about manners, and the food experience really includes being a good participant at the table, both from a conversation standpoint and then just being, you know, not necessarily being rigid, but just being mindful of how you kind of comport yourself there at the table, right?
That's exactly right. I always said that manners isn't so much where you put the fork, but it's the combined efforts of people to minimize one another's discomfort in all ways. And, you know, and I think that manners, it's not a fixed thing. I think the protocol varies with the circumstances, because there are times one really does need to, you know, sit up straight and use that linen napkin and so forth. And there are times where the mannerly thing to do is to join in the fun and to laugh and do the boarding house reach across the table for that last dinner roll and stuff. So I think manners are just being attuned to the opportunities of the circumstances.
I found a phrase that's attributed to you that I really, really love. And I'll just read that to you real quickly. It's feed the hungry and heartbroken. And I just love that. What do you mean by that phrase?
Well, that actually referred back to a television show, a wonderful series that's on PBS called The Chef and the Farmer that I've had the privilege of being a guest for a few times. And we were talking about casseroles. And, you know, casseroles can be dreadful. They can be glorious, but there is an inherent sentimentality about them. And the host of the show said, so what is the purpose of a casserole? And I said, well, it's to feed the hungry and the heartbroken. And I think you can apply that to a number of different comforts, whatever those comforts might be, that, you know, when you're hungry, the gift of feeding a hungry person is a formidable thing. And if you're aching, if your heart is broken for any reason, the solace and the restorative reassurance you can get from a bowl of something that feels like comfort to you, I don't know of a much more gratifying human experience, because it is a form of love.
Yeah, it really is. Well, we are talking to Sherry Castle today, and Sherry is going to be at the Smithsonian Associates coming up on November 3rd. I, too, come from an era of casseroles. And purposely, Sherry, we're talking today just before lunchtime. And we're doing that over the phone. And so it's a little hard to kind of visually take into account what some of your recipes really kind of involve. But if you were going to be cooking lunch today for us, and you probably are going to be cooking lunch, but what would you cook, and how in particular would you describe some of the tastes that you might offer in a lunch cooked by you today?
Well, I would say that in pretty much any meal I cook, and, you know, I am one of the hats I wear is as a professional cook and cooking teacher, and I like to give people a view of familiar things with fresh eyes. I believe it's important for people to recognize what they're eating, but yet have an element of surprise and delight. So let's say I'm making a good old grilled cheese sandwich, just to pick something off the top of my head. Well, you know, I would use good cheese and I would use good bread, but I might do something like put a little tomato jam on there, or a few slices of crisp, juicy apple, or something where it's like, wow, I've had grilled cheese sandwiches my whole life, but I've never had it quite this way. And I think to me that that is, you know, some of the most genius food out there. And I'm not saying all my food is genius, because it's not, but I'm impressed by people who do the simple things well and can make us fall back in love with the things we've known for a long time. I think in some ways I apply very traditional Mediterranean techniques to traditional Southern ingredients.
My taste buds are salivating right now, so we're gonna.
Well, come on, get in the car. You can be here in a few hours.
I know. I'm not far away, so you'll have to really think about that invitation seriously. Well, another question that I have for you really has to do with this kind of idea of socialization. My wife is from Iowa. She's a farm girl, and she remembers socializing really on the back porch, snapping beans for canning. Mm-hmm. And you've talked mm-hmm. a little bit about creating a canning kind of environment and certain tasks that you undertake. And tasks were very important during that farm life that my wife really grew up on. She's, you know, we don't live that way any longer, of course, but some of that still can be recreated for us. And so when we think about food, it does involve a certain amount of feeding and these tastes, these wonderful tastes, but there's also some socialization that goes with it. And you're really a proponent of that too.
I am. I mean, I think that the shared joys of eating with someone, which doesn't necessarily mean that you have to talk the whole time. I mean, you can have a wonderful social meal in complete silence, eating alone at the counter of a good cafe by watching the interactions of the other people. Or you can have one of these, you know, the house is full, everybody's got plates and cups and napkins are strewn in the floor. I think that social can be a lot of different things, but it's that shared experience that's common in your enjoyment, but not necessarily common in your interpretation of it. But I've had, you know, I live alone now, but I have all sorts of wonderful social notions by just using some of the, you know, some of the spoons my grandmother had, or sitting in lawn chairs in my dad's backyard and snapping beans just the way he did with his parents. Mm-hmm. So, you know, shared joy and shared experience is a essence of who we are as people. It's one of the hallmarks of civilization, which is why I say, if you really want to get to know people, whether it's somebody sitting next to you on a train or in a foreign country or a new relationship, start talking about food, because that's where our little truths and our little stories and our charm comes out.
Well, your newest book is Rhubarb, and mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting title, because you say this is just it's more than pie, and I think that that's true. You do need to think of some of these things as being other than what they might appear, particularly Appalachian foods like chocolate gravy come to mind, and that's something you're going to be talking about. Tell us a little bit about the history of that food and why. I mean, we're not talking about like a chocolate fountain at a wedding here. We're talking about something a little different.
Oh, although I like that idea, maybe a tier of cast iron skillets, you know, pulling down. But chocolate gravy is a wonderful thing that people too often recoil from because they don't understand the moniker. It goes back to an old practice of at one time in colonial cooking, anything that was prepared in a skillet thickened with a roux, whether it was sweet or savory, was called a gravy. So chocolate gravy is a thick, rich, delicious chocolate sauce. It's slightly thinner than pudding. It is slightly thicker than fudge sauce, but it's traditionally eaten over biscuits, although no one ever complains if you put it over ice cream or pound cake. My personal favorite in the spring, my take on strawberry shortcake, is to make fresh scones, split them, top them with fresh berries, and then ladle chocolate gravy over the top. The origin is amazing to me because it is an example of the resourceful genius of humble home cooks. You know, even not maybe only a generation or two ago, people had access to some farmstead things, even if they no longer lived on the farm. You could get good milk and butter and eggs. And from a company store, either a country store or maybe a store in a mining camp or in some, you know, modest retail environment, you could get a little cocoa powder and a little bit of sugar. So what you do to make chocolate gravy is you take some butter, although I've seen it done it with bacon drippings and other forms of fat. You put in some sugar and some cocoa and milk, and you cook it until it's in this rich, delicious, glossy, fudgy sauce. And it was a way for people that had almost nothing to make a sweet treat for their children. That, to me, that's a whole novel right there in one skillet, is the power and the persuasion and the genius of chocolate gravy.
That's great. That's beautiful. Yeah. Again, this storytelling of yours is really just fantastic. I think that's what we really are going to be looking forward to when we see you at the Smithsonian Associates. I think one of the other interesting things that I read about you, because I mentioned this Southern Living Community Cookbook that will be available for us there to purchase and have you sign. But one of the things that I read that I thought was great is that you personally have read every recipe from, I think it was 1966 to 2014, is that right? 1960?
That's exactly right. Their first issue of Southern Living came out in February of 1965, actually it was, and then went to, and then, you know, through today, and through some work that I used to do for them, and I actually was a staffer for a short period of time, and in preparation of this community cookbook, I read front to back, sequentially, not once but twice, every recipe they ever published.
Wow.
And so far as we know, I'm the only person to ever do so. And it really, you talk about, you know, an immersion into culinary history and the good, the bad, the ugly, and everything else, to see how our attitudes and our groceries changed over those five decades was pretty formidable and certainly informative.
Gosh. So again, the new Southern Garden Cookbook is what's out, and you're going to be talking a little bit about that at Smithsonian Associates. What else are you going to share with us? Don't give away everything, but whet our appetites a little bit and our taste buds a little bit.
Well, when I received their kind invitation, they said they wanted me to talk about Appalachian food, which is having a moment, but perhaps not enough moments, because Appalachian food is a kind of Southern food, but it is not the same as Southern food. The analogy I like to use is Appalachian food is to Southern food what bourbon is to whiskey. It's certainly part of the category, but it's unlike the rest. The thing that distinguishes mountain food is, although geographically we are in the South, geologically, we are like we are in New England. So our growing season, our crops, a lot of our food preservations and techniques are much more like things you would find in New England, in the Pennsylvania Dutch and up in there, as opposed to the rest of the South, certainly the coastal South. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about what does that mean? What does that mean for what we ate and why we ate it and why we are world-class geniuses in food preservation? And to make some of these points, I'm going to take about 10 or 12 iconic dishes that you're just not going to find anywhere else on the planet other than in the mountain south of the United States, and talk about where they came from and why they're so great and what they teach us. And I'm going to pick something, not quite sure what yet, but I'm going to pick at least one thing and hand out samples, because, you know, some things are better eaten than told.
That's true. Well, what a great story that's going to be, and what a wonderful experience it's going to be to see you, hear you, and learn about all of this fantastic history. I guess I really just have kind of one final question for you. I like to ask this of chefs and cooks. If you could sit down for a meal with anybody, past, present, future, even, who would that be and why? I'm sure they'd be very impressed by your story, but whose story are you impressed with as a storyteller?
You know, this is going to perhaps even be cliched, but I would love to have met my great-grandmother. She died two decades before my dad was born, much less me. But I am told that she was legendary with her cooking, that somehow, even though she grew up deep in the heart of the Blue Ridge Mountains, she found ways to travel and saw the Pacific and the Atlantic and the Gulf and so forth. And I would just love to meet the esteemed Miss Lily and thank her for launching my family.
That's wonderful. The esteemed Miss Lily. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for joining us today on the show. We'll look forward to seeing you on November 3rd when you're going to be talking about shuck beans, stack cake, and chocolate gravy, of course. But Sherry Castle, thanks for joining us. Anything else I've left out? We'll put links to your site, and of course, there'll be links to where to get tickets. But I'm going to be there, and I'm looking forward to meeting you, and you have the last word.
Well, the last word is I really hope people will come. I promise we're going to have a good time, and we just might have chocolate gravy.
That's great. That we'll have a crowd. Absolutely. So thank you, Sherry Castle, very much.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yeah, wonderful. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks to all my guests today, all the help on the podcast, and especially to Media Studio Edit, and the great work by Wayne Brown and his team for editing the podcast and making me sound so much better. That is to say, not old, but better. Thanks to all.